In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk movies. We do it every Monday afternoon on Downtown. It's Pass the Popcorn with Alan Adams of The Main Edge, who joins us in studio. Greetings, friend.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Monday has arrived.
It has. Indeed, it has.
Did you prepare for it well with a... Well, it's not a relaxing weekend for you, because I know Sunday's a busy writing day.
Yeah, the weekend is essentially part of my work week. Mm. But you know, it's like we try to make arrange things so that we can have a little bit of flexibility with our with our good times. You know, my in-laws were in town on Friday, and they we went out to dinner with them.
Nice.
They wanted to. It was a belated birthday celebration, and so. So that was nice. But yeah, like just, I mean, it was a relatively, sort of low key, kind of weekend. Although I will say, I did get out to the Pride event at, Bangor Muni, on Saturday. That was, a lot of fun. Although, I was, man, when you go first, it's tough. It's tough.
Oh.
Yeah. So I got,
it a scramble?
No, it was like a drive, pitch and putt competition. Which is fine. Like I actually managed to get into one on the driving range, despite having not really swung a club with any real meaning in 5 years, probably.
Oof.
So that was good. Pitching was okay, but the putting is what got me, because I was unprepared for how slow the greens were, and so I just didn't have enough mustard on it, and so I was in the lead in my division going into the putting, but. But the guy behind me came roaring back because, you know, he was not deceived by the slowness of the greens, and so actually putted with some degree of authority.
Drive for show, putt for dough.
Yes, that is that is a lesson that was brought home to me very very strongly this weekend. But no, you know, so you get out there, you have some fun, and that's really what it's all about.
Well, we're very sad around here after the news of the death of our friend Ed Asner over the weekend, and you're connected to that as well, because you were scheduled to be in a play with Ed over in Brewer last April that got shut down for COVID, and his daughter Liza had just reached out to me a couple of weeks ago to see if we could get it back on the schedule for this year.
It's such a bummer, and it was you know, it's one of those things where I was I just remember being so looking so forward to it. To the experience of, you know, just, I mean, God, just sharing the stage with a dude like that, you know what I mean? And, you know, and to have that sort of opportunity, you know, delayed, at least, you know, initially it was, and now that it's gone, and it's just, and it breaks your heart, especially for all the people, the many, many people who, Ed Asner, he touched so many lives. And, you know, one of the things, it's a mixed blessing. But one of the things about when someone like this passes is you start to hear the stories that maybe you hadn't heard before. You always sort of guess that you have certain guesses with regards to people's personal beliefs by the way they speak. But I mean, like Ed Asner was a bomb thrower. Like he was like real deal. And you know, and I didn't know that about him. Because you know, a lot of that stuff happened kind of before my time.
Yeah, what he did for the union, holy cow.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, and it's just so easy to, you know, it's so easy to boil someone like that down into, you know, it's like, you know, he was, not that it wasn't a brilliant role, but he's more than Lou Grant, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And it's just, it is just a darn shame that we have to say goodbye.
Absolutely. Well said. Let's talk movies. You got to see four since we met with you last time.
Yeah, there was a bunch.
A lot. Where do we begin?
Well, let's start with the one I went to the movie theater to see one. Although I will, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I've taken to wearing a mask while I watch movies
in the
movie theater.
Makes sense.
You know, and it's like, even when, you know, there's like half a dozen people in the room, and it's a, you know, and the theaters are big, and you know, everyone's spaced out. It's one of those things where it's like, you're probably fine, but I'm not in a place where I'm ready to count on probably. So right. For the record, for anyone out there listening, if you do go to the movie theater, you know, wear a mask. You'll forget you're wearing it within the first 5 minutes, right. And then you can just sit there and enjoy the film and feel a little bit better about your presence there. So I went to see Candyman, the new movie. It's directed by Nia DaCosta, produced by Jordan Peele, and it is a sequel of sorts to the 1992 film of the same name. This one is set in the present day, and it follows an artist played by a young man named Anthony McCoy, played by the always wonderful Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who was so good as Bobby Seale in Trial of Chicago 7.
Oh, yeah.
He plays an artist living in Chicago, struggling with a creative block and not entirely sure how to move forward from this. Then one night, he hears the story of this woman, Helen Lyle. Helen Lyle being the role Virginia Madsen played in the 1992 Candyman film. And so that story is related to him. He develops this fascination, makes his way to Cabrini Green, and starts looking around. That's where he encounters a gentleman who shares with him the full story of the Candyman, the sort of urban legend character that you say his name five times in the mirror and he pops up and brutally and frankly quite vividly murders you. The deal is the guy sort of becomes obsessed with the story and it starts infiltrating his art practice, due to circumstances, you hate to spoil it, but the movie's called Candyman. Candyman shows up, Rich. I don't think it's spoiling anything to say that the dude turns up. The body count rises pretty fast and in a pretty visceral way. Our hero Anthony is left to deal with the spiraling situation and not entirely sure what, if anything, he can do to alleviate what's going on. It's interesting because I've always been a big proponent of genre filmmaking's ability to address societal issues in a way that more straightforward cinema can't, simply because you have that added layer of remove. The 1992 version of this film does address some of that, the sort of institutionalized fear and pain and anger that comes with being a black person in America. But it had to be much subtler in those sort of evocations because, it was the early 90s. Like it or not, like the majority of mainstream audiences weren't ready for that.
Right.
But in 2021, we've been a little more primed. And so especially when you've got someone like Jordan Peele behind the scenes, someone who has already illustrated a real proclivity for using these sort of genre conventions in a way to explore society's ills in a very clear way. And we get a lot of that in this. That sort of messaging, it sort of moves from the subtextual to the textual in a way that, frankly, I wasn't quite expecting. I wasn't quite expecting it to be as thoughtful in that way. I figured it would be just because of the players involved. But you never really know just how... you don't expect a movie about a magical mirror slasher killer to be thoughtful about the black experience in America, as well as addressing things like gentrification, and some of the foibles of the art world tossed in there as well. So this is a movie that had a surprising amount to say in between the, again, I can't stress enough, incredibly graphic bloodletting.
All right, that's Candyman. Up next, how about Vacation Friends?
Okay, so, sometimes you go to the movies and you're like, I really want to be challenged and I want to think about stuff and I want big ideas presented to me in an interesting way. And sometimes you just want to laugh at fart jokes and people falling down. Vacation Friends falls very firmly in the latter category. It's newly streaming on Hulu. It stars Lil Rel Howery and John Cena. Yeah, it's all right there in the title. So you've got a couple, Marcus, that's Lil Rel Howery, and Emily, played by Yvonne Orji. And they're from Chicago, and they're going on vacation to this big fancy resort in Mexico. And there's a big plan. Marcus has gone to great pains to put together what he expects to be this wonderful sort of proposal moment. Like, he's made deals with the concierge and all that stuff. But when they show up, they've been told that the plans have all been executed. But when they get to their room, it turns out that the suite above them, the jacuzzi overflowed, flooded their room, and so everything is ruined. Not only is everything ruined, but there are no more rooms at the hotel, and so they're going to have to go stay at the Best Western by the airport. Until they encounter another couple. You've got Ron, that's John Cena, and Kyla, played by Meredith Hagner. And they are a particularly hard-partying pair that just so happened to be occupying the suite above their room.
Oh.
And the overflowing jacuzzi and whatnot. And so, you know, Ron and, you know, Ron and Kyla decide, you know what, why don't you guys come and stay with us? And so they get into a utterly debauched week of Mexican fun, like drinking and drugs and partying and dancing all night and all sorts of hazily remembered antics. But then, you know, we reach the end of the vacation, and they sort of go their separate ways. You know, Ron and Kyla try to get contact information for Marcus and Emily, who sort of brush them off because it's like, you know, they're viewing them as, well, vacation friends. Jump forward a few months. We're in Atlanta. Marcus and Emily are finally getting married. It's this lavish party in Atlanta. Her father, who's paying for the whole thing, Harold, played by Robert Wisdom, does not care for Marcus due to a number of incidents, including one in which he apparently punched Emily's brother in the face, though we don't get an explanation for that one for a while. You know, they're all very tense about it. It's like it's all very she and very everything has to be very by the book, and Marcus is dealing with his future father-in-law's disdain for him. And it's all, you know, it's all a struggle, but it's all going okay until, well, then Ron and Kyla show up. They found their way to the wedding.
Oh, boy.
Have decided that they are going to stay. Well, Rich, hijinks ensue.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun. Like, I'll freely admit that I had a good time watching this movie. Like, it's not great cinema by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, it's funny. Like, I like Lil Rel Howery. I think he has a very particular quality that I think works in certain roles, and this is one of those roles. Man, I gotta tell you, like, it took me a while to come around, but I'm starting to climb on board the Cena train as far as like him as a performer.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, you know, I think I faulted him because he didn't have the same sort of charisma, like movie star charisma, that The Rock did. Mm. And, you know, and he doesn't. And that's okay, because
not everybody can get him. That's pretty unusual.
You know, and it's like, and here's the thing. I think Cena's a better comedic actor than The Rock is.
Interesting.
Like, I do. And it's like, between this and his work in the Suicide Squad, I'm like, man, I mean, I still think The Rock is an A++ movie star, one of maybe five that we have, and I don't think Cena ever gets there. And I would be willing to have a conversation about the fact that I think maybe Dave Bautista is a better actor than either of them. But yeah, I'm really on board with Cena. I mean, that central quartet is why this movie works. They're very good together. They have wonderful comedic chemistry. There are a couple of pretty solid, like, comedic set pieces that really work. You know, again, it's a little overstuffed, and like some of the stuff maybe falls a little bit flat. You know, not all the jokes land, but enough do where you're going to have a good time. And yeah, it's all in all, like, vacation friends, worth the trip.
All right. We're talking movies with Alan Adams here on Downtown. I'm looking at the cast of He's All That, and I and I suddenly feel older than I have at any time in my life, because I've literally never heard of any of these people.
Well, Richard, He's All That is what you would call it's a gender inverted adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's 1913 classic Pygmalion.
Wow. Now I feel worse.
What He's All That is a gender inverted version of 1999's classic teen comedy She's All That. Which itself was based on, you know, inspired by My Fair Lady, which was again inspired by the aforementioned Pygmalion. This movie not good, Rich. It is not good at all.
Shaw's not coming back from the dead to celebrate this work.
I mean, he's slowly rotating, I think. Yes, but yeah. And again, I'm someone who, I was a little too old for She's All That when it first came out. Like I was, you know, I was in my early 20s, and it's very much a high school movie, but it is also very much of its era, in a way that, you know, a lot of late 90s sort of pop culture was. And so I'm always going to have a fondness in my heart for it. I don't know that the movie certainly didn't need to be sort of revisited. The fact that it's Netflix doing it isn't necessarily ideal because, you know, there are points in this movie where you can almost smell the algorithm. Like, it's just like, oh, okay, I understand what's happening now. Particularly when you take into account the fact that the star of the movie, who plays a high school senior who is, you know, sort of building her college fund by being like a lifestyle, like style influencer or whatever. Like, that's actually what she does. Like, she's an actual like TikTok, like maven or whatever they are.
Right.
And then I don't remember her name. I don't remember any of their names.
Addison Rae.
Yeah,
is that her?
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay. I'm not going to look them up because I can't be bothered, nor should you, because you should not be bothered as well. But it's the basic gist. She's this influencer, goes to a posh California high school. Her boyfriend is a fellow sort of TikTok online influencer type. But she winds up getting embarrassed by him when he's fooling around with another woman. And so she winds up taking a bet with one of her mean girl friends, saying, I bet you can't take the biggest loser in this school and turn him into the prom king. And she's like, you're on. And then, you know, they find the random long hair who wears like Joy Division t-shirts and carries a camera. And they're like, that guy. And and then she does her best to sort of ingratiate herself into his life and turn him into the prom king, you know, to win the bet, obviously. But as often happens in these situations, well, Rich, she starts to have feelings. About this young man. She starts to wonder what's going to happen if/when he ever finds out about this bet. Mm. Like, how is that going to impact things? And you know what? He's gonna find out about the bet because that's how these movies work.
Yes.
You're gonna and then you see. Look, it's bad. Like, it's just bad. It was a bad time. You know, and again, She's All That was not a cinematic masterpiece by any mind, but at least it had an ethos. Like, right. it was of its era. Like, this movie just seems like it's just so empty. you know, while that early movie was packed with people who would go on to significant stardom over the next 10, 20 years in terms of movies, I don't anticipate we're going to hear a lot from these folks on the big screen going forward. Again, like, you know, phone screens and laptop screens and whatnot, they'll probably be everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm never going to see them because, again, I'm old. But yeah, again, the movie's not great. They do bring back a couple of the people from from She's All That, although in different roles. Rachel Lee Cook shows up. Matthew Lillard is here.
Oh.
But it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, good for you guys. Like, I mean, I hope you got a decent check because otherwise, I don't know why you are here. I don't know why anyone is here. He's All That. Not really all that at all.
Finally, Bob Ross, Happy Accidents, Betrayal, and Greed. Who knew there was so much drama in the story of Bob Ross?
You know, it's so funny because, like, I remember hearing, like, bits about story.
We had his daughter on the show a while back. Yeah, who's sort of the curator of the Bob Ross flame.
You know, and it's just, it's so interesting because, you know, you hear about the conflict between, you know, the corporate entity that is Bob Ross Enterprises and, like, the family and all that stuff. Like, I'd heard bits and pieces of that, but I'd never seen it all sort of put together. Now, first of all, I was concerned that this movie was just going to be unrelentingly bleak as far as, like, you know, just sad about people, like the exploitation of a legacy and all that stuff. And there is a lot of that, but only in like the last third of the movie. Like, the first hour or so is very much a celebration of Bob Ross and sort of walking us through his story, even as we're sort of introduced to the idea of these people who would eventually take advantage and exploit his image, which was really fascinating. The central figure of this documentary is probably Steve Ross, who is Bob's son, who appeared on multiple episodes of The Joy of Painting alongside his dad. He's a talented painter in his own right. But it's this conversation about the people, specifically Annette and Walt Kowalski, who he feels have somehow have cheated him out of his connection to his dad's legacy in the interest of profiting. And I will say, like, as far as the movie is concerned, it really does seem like a lot of shady stuff went on, particularly right at the end of Bob Ross's life. Like, he's been gone for almost 30 years now. Yeah. Like, he passed away in 1995.
Oh. Now, we had Joan, I'm checking back in our archives, we had Joan Kowalski on.
Okay, so she is she is the daughter of Annette and Walt. And, well, and there's also an allusion to potential affair, so who knows whose daughter she... But that's neither here nor there. You got to be careful, because the Kowalskis apparently very litigious.
Oh, dear.
So much so that...
love you, Joan.
According to the documentary filmmakers, more than a dozen people, like, close to Bob Ross, who had initially agreed to be involved with the documentary, bailed out, all stating the same reason... They didn't want to get sued, dragged into court by the Kowalskis. So it's such a messy sort of situation. But it's also fascinating, because he was such this strangely compelling figure. Like, you know, he's just a quiet dude, like, painting landscapes on PBS. Mm. Like, and yet there are people who weren't even alive when he stopped doing that show, right, who are fully aware of who Bob Ross is. He remains a pop cultural presence, whether it's on, you know, TV or you know, on the internet, what have you. Like, just this, you know, and we get to hear a little bit about how that person came to be. We get to hear a little bit about the behind the scenes person that he was, which was, I'm sure you'll be shocked to find out, essentially the same dude that you saw on television. although his director, there's this wonderful bit in the doc where his director, the woman who directed the majority of the Joy of Painting episodes, said, yeah, you know, it's the same guy, except, you know, off camera, like, he had a tendency to tell ornery jokes.
Ornery jokes.
And I'm like, and like, I hear that and I'm like, okay, two things. One, I don't know what an ornery joke is.
I don't either.
Two, I desperately want to hear Bob Ross tell me an ornery joke.
Yes.
Because, wow, that would be awesome. But yeah, so little snippets like that, like, you know, and there's a wonderful anecdote. I won't spoil it, but there's a wonderful anecdote about where they talk about how, where the voice came from, like that sort of soft spokenness and things like that. And then in the end, we start to hear more about the conflicts between Steve Ross and Bob Ross's friends, and the enterprise that is Bob Ross Incorporated or whatever. So it was it's this really interesting sort of dichotomy, I guess. You know, there's a bit of a he said they said kind of vibe to it, but at the same time, like, as things are sort of illustrated, the way they're laid out, you're just like, man, something doesn't smell quite right. But again, like, you know, the this has been played out in the courts on numerous occasions. So, right, wrong, who knows? But I will say it was a really fascinating look at a guy who really is, in a lot of ways, a pop cultural icon, even now, some, you know, 25 years after his death.
Awesome. Alan Adams talking movies with us on Downtown. Thank you, Al.
My pleasure.